welcome to the seventh season of Scene to Song, a musical theater podcast for people who love to discuss, critique, and celebrate musicals as a literary art form. I'm your host, Shoshana Greenberg, and each episode I'll bring on a guest to talk about a musical, musical theater writer, or a topic or trend in musical theater. My guest today is Beth Ann Freed Cohen. Beth Ann is a home care nurse and educator. She sings with the New York City-based choruses, Essential Voices USA, and the Yiddish Philharmonic Chorus, which has been singing Yiddish choral repertoire since 1922. We're going to talk today about the bimbo or ditz character in Sondheim musicals. Hey, Beth Ann, welcome back to the podcast.
I'm so excited to be here.
I think this is your fourth appearance. That's aside from the finale group episodes.
I feel like I've been more of a finale group episode connoisseur.
So welcome back. And before we get into our topic, we'll start with some more get to know our guest questions. So what's the last great musical you saw?
So I got to say, I looked through your get to know our guest questions and I realized that I have one show for all of them, which is the last show I saw. So that works out too. So I did get to see Once Upon a Mattress at City Center and it was really great. Why don't you read me the four questions and I'll tell you how this answers all of them.
Okay.
It's like, it's going to be like a Seder.
So I think this show answers the question, last great musical you saw, is there a classic show you saw recently for the first time? And what was your experience with it? What musical has made you laugh the most?
And okay, just the three. Okay. Yeah. So I have seen Once Upon a Mattress before. I actually talked about it on our group episode, seeing it in my friend's living room. Well, I didn't see it in her living room. I saw a video of the production of it in her living room.
I was like, that sounds like an interesting production.
They do these productions all the time. And I mentioned it before. It's called Small and Casual. It's in the Boston area. They do musicals in people's living rooms and it's amazing.
Wow.
Actually, my friend had a correction for what I said in your podcast about it. I said that they had cast a woman as the king and had kind of a queering of it. And I was like, well, in amateur theater, you kind of cast who you have. And my friend corrected me to say, no, they like to take whatever chance they can to queer things up. So it wasn't just like, who do we have? It was like, you know, on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Which
I think it can be both, but.
Sure.
So I had seen it before. I think I also saw it when I was in, I don't know, probably junior high and high school at a production at a different high school. So it wasn't the first time I saw it. It was definitely the first time I've seen it professionally and I found it delightful. I guess there were some changes to the book that I honestly have no idea what they were, so because I don't know the show well enough to have noticed, but
yeah, I think the main one is that they combine two minor characters.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't know the show super super well enough to have noticed it, so yeah.
People have been talking about it a lot, but Michael Urie he was just phenomenal, and this was just the perfect role for Sutton Foster and the physicality of it, and it was just delightful. The thing was that when I saw it, I was in the middle of going through some really tough personal stuff, and I was really sad, and sad enough that I like kind of was sobbing in the middle of one of the funniest parts of the show at one point, but it still made me laugh like a bunch. So I was, you know, I was having a very sad time in my life, but going to the show and, you know, having some sadness wave over me at like various times, but then also being able to go back to the show and the joy of it was, laughter is good. Laughter is good. So I laughed a lot. It was hilarious. And the cast was, it was really great.
Well, we knocked out three questions already. Do you have a favorite song, melody, or musical phrase in musical theater?
So I will always tell anybody that my favorite song is Make Our Curtain Grow from Candide. It is just an absolutely gorgeous melody, and I think the lyric is also beautiful, and I love the message of it. I walk down the aisle to it. I'm not like musically sophisticated enough to explain what's so wonderful about it. But the idea that we're not perfect and we're not going to live perfect lives, but we can enjoy what we've got and make the most of what we got and contribute something to the world, I really love a lot.
That's a beautiful melody for sure. And the core, and it's so
the choral, beautiful, the choral arrangement. So yeah. The way it's put together with it starting with the solos. Okay, the word, I thought the world was sugar cake, is just a terrible line, but the rest of it is so good, it makes up for it. Right. And then, yeah, the chorus coming in, and it's just, it's amazing.
As someone working in the medical field, is there a musical that you think gets an area of medicine or an experience with a medical condition really right in some way?
So I actually couldn't think of a musical that gets it right. So for everyone out there who doesn't know, I'm a nurse, and I have a lot of experience working with people with dementia, but also other stuff. And in my real life, I train people to be home health workers. I train people to take care of other people. So I like to say I white bucks by proxy in my, is my job. I used to do it for myself. I used to do it not by proxy, but now I do it by proxy. I do occasionally care for people still, but mostly I do it, I teach. People get this stuff so wrong. I mean, most people just get it really wrong. I love Next to Normal a lot. Actually, it's the show I saw most on Broadway. I think I saw it 4 times live. Well, we saw it in DC.
Yeah.
And then I saw it on Broadway 3 times. And I mean, that's the most I've ever seen a show on Broadway. And it's amazing. And I love the show. It's a big problem because it really propagates a lot of misunderstanding of psychiatry, and specifically the use of electroconvulsive therapy. Not that I know much about that, but one thing that I think is a problem in a lot of popular culture and media when it comes to illness, and especially mental illness, is everybody just wants to know why. And everybody wants to have a reason for people being sick, a reason for people being mentally ill, a way to have it have meaning. And it often just doesn't. When you look at a lot of these cases, it just kind of sucks. And there's no like grander meaning that we can always find with these things. So I really love Next to Normal. I think it's really not right when it comes to some of her interactions with her therapist, and especially in terms of the side effects of the electroconvulsive therapy. Memory loss is a real thing. It doesn't look like that. that's not how memory loss manifests. I mean, there could be a case where something like that has happened, but it's just not really like that. And I also did want to shout out the show Working, which actually pays attention to healthcare workers at least a little bit. I feel like the people who write musical theater are not, there's not a lot of overlap with healthcare workers and people who write musical theater. So you see a lot of people whose understanding of the working world is often, you know, waitressing and office work and things that like a lot of those people do. But you kind of have to dig a little bit harder to see what it's like in the world of direct care workers. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's such a great thing about working, about the musical working.
Musical working, yes, yeah. That's what we're referring to.
Yeah. Well, cool. Let's move on to our topic, which is going to be talking about Sondheim and the bimbo character, which when you brought this to me, I was immediately intrigued because it is true that there are a lot of characters in Sondheim musicals that are, whether they're ditzy or, well, we'll go into all the different types, but it's, I never really thought too much about them, but because Sondheim writes so smartly, but yeah, they're all throughout his work. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah. So I originally brought this to you as the dits in musical theater or the dits of Sondheim. I don't know. I think the word dits has a connotation of being airbrain or airheaded, you know, forgetful maybe even. And I think bimbo is maybe more accurate that we're talking about. So from dictionary.com, it says a bimbo is an attractive but stupid young woman. So I think that that's like spot on for what we're looking for.
Yeah, it just is in such contrast to, I usually think of Sondheim's characters as like really smart, really articulate and verbose and intellectual and New York City neurotic and all that. But they're not all like that.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of these.
Yeah.
And so one thing that I think is just kind of a funny truth is that Sondheim was a genius. And so to him, everyone's kind of stupid. Like if you're a genius, then you're just used to talking to people who are not as smart as you. And I mm-hmm. think that there is a thing of like every conversation you have is, I mean, I didn't know him, but my sense is he was a kind person. And so he had to find a way to respect and be kind to people, you know, the rest of the idiots among him. So maybe to him, it wasn't such a difference between, you know, a normal intelligence person and maybe a lower, or I don't know. I'm putting a lot of things into his head right now, but it occurs to me that that could be part of this. But what really struck me was his deep respect for some of these characters, not all of them. Mm-hmm. So what do I mean when I'm talking about somebody who's a ditz or a bimbo? So it could be that they're not very smart, right? That they're stupid and make a lot of mistakes or something. But I think more deeply, it's an anti-intellectual bent, not interested in high culture or reading, maybe. I think maybe people will be a little surprised of who my original entry into this field was, which is Phyllis from Follies. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people would be like, what? She's not a bimbo. Mm-hmm. But I think one of my very first experiences of Follies was at the Museum of Television and Radio. They did a summer program of Sondheim stuff. And there was a recording of somebody doing Lucy and Jesse with dancers and like a televised thing, because that's what they did at the museum. And I loved the song. It actually wasn't until I was listening to your podcast and you were talking about that song with somebody on your podcast, I don't remember who, And the guy who was talking about it was like, well, obviously it's supposed to be Phyllis and the other character.
Sally.
It's supposed to be Phyllis and Sally, but on a deeper level, it could be Phyllis and Phyllis's younger self. And I was like, oh, it never occurred to me it was supposed to be Phyllis and Sally.
Mm-hmm.
At no point did I think it was supposed to be Phyllis. I always thought it was Phyllis and young Phyllis. Because when I saw the song, I didn't know who Sally was.
Right.
I only knew it as her, you know, telling a story. And I thought she was just telling a story about herself, about how once she was young and naive, and now she's like old and jaded, and she wishes she could be both at the same time. You know, I guess when you compare her to Sally, maybe she's the more sophisticated of the two. But what really struck me when I did finally see the show is, and I guess Sondheim didn't write this part, but her speech about going to the museums. Now, if you know anything about me, and if you want to follow me on Instagram, you can find out. Bethann loves museums. I go to a lot of museums. I love art. And when she does that speech about going to the museums and how hard it was for her, I was like, okay, on a very, very fundamental level, I do not understand this person. This person who thinks that her life is so hard because she has to go to these museums. And for so long, it really was like just such a turnoff to me of this character of like, oh my God, lady, shut up. Like, you're rich. You get to like go experience the best art in the world. You get to do interesting things. Like, what's the big problem? Like, I just could not connect to her at all. So, you know, in a sense, she has this anti-intellectual streak of not wanting to learn stuff, but I eventually came around, dear audience, don't worry. And to understand that what's really going on there of she is, you know, she was a talented dancer or, you know, to be in the Follies and landed a rich up and coming guy who just never accepted her for who she was and needed her to be something else than she was. He needed her to say the right things and know the right art. And so he forced her to go to these museums and research so that she could be the right kind of woman to make the right kind of impression on the right kind of guests. And the tragedy of that and the ickiness of that. And so she was really my first thought when I thought about this idea of Sondheim having this true respect for this woman for being the bimbo that she is, right? And that's not being a bad thing. And I know a lot of people are going to be like, she's not a bimbo, but I'm like, maybe she is. And maybe we are just, or maybe that's the wrong word, but like, she's not interested in being smart. You know, and that's okay. And she has other wonderful things about her. And also that who she is a wonderful thing.
I was looking, I have the Follies script. I was looking for the, where she mentions the museum. Is it where she's, where young Phyllis says that when they're getting engaged and she says, good isn't enough. He says, you'll make a good wife, Phil. And she says, good isn't enough. I need to grow. I know that. And I will. I'll study and I'll read and I'll walk my feet off in the Metropolitan Museum. You'll be so proud of me.
Yeah, that's exactly the walk my feet off in the museum. I always remember that line because the fact that this musical has such true empathy for that and that she's really the hero of the piece. And of course, like the fact that James Goldman had and Sondheim, we know that they like art and they like music, obviously, but that they could have empathy for this woman who saw that as a job, as a way of making herself worthy for this guy that she loved. And that there was a tragedy in that feeling that she had that she wasn't good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think you can then see the disdain that she has for all of that stuff when, like, could I leave you? When she's like, all this is yours. All this stuff that we have we did is yours.
That's the other part of this is, like, that song, like, I really have trouble. I still, even at that point in the show, I still really have trouble empathizing with her. I'm like, holy shit, you get to be in a room with a Brock every day? Like, you get to talk to these interesting people? Like, to me, I don't know, sounds pretty good.
Could I leave you? No, the point is, could you leave me? Well, I guess you could leave me the house. Leave me the flat, leave me the Brocks and Chagalls and all that. You could leave me the stocks for sentiment's sake, and 90% of the money you make, and the rugs and the cooks. Darling, you keep the drugs, Angel, you keep the books. Honey, I'll take the grand, Sugar, you keep the spinach, and all of our friends. And just wait a goddamn minute, what leave you? How could I leave you, sweetheart? I have to confess.
Phyllis is just not a person. She's a person who I can understand because she's so real well written that the writing makes me understand her. But she's not necessarily somebody I can relate to.
Going back to the story of Lucy and Jesse, plus Abba Underneath, which is the alternate Phyllis song, I think in those you really see how she is kind of scared of who she actually is because she doesn't really know who she is because she's been trying to be this other person for Ben for so long.
Yeah. She's just the first. She's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, bimbos in musical theater.
Yeah. Well, it's
fun time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that she was your way into this because there's definitely more stereotypical bimbos that Sondheim has written, like April in Company.
Well, let's start at the very beginning with Philia in...
Yes,
I mean, obviously in A Funny Thing Happened to the Way Through... On the way to the forum, we have, like, the archetype here.
Yeah.
Who sings the archetype song, like, laying out what it is to be a bimbo. Lovely is the one thing I can do.
Yeah.
My name is Hero.
My name is Philia.
Philia.
I am a courtesan, and a courtesan has but one talent.
I'm lovely. All I am is lovely. Lovely is the one thing I can do. Winsome, what I am is winsome. Radiant as in some dream come true.
Say my name.
Just say your name?
Yes.
Very well. I forgot it.
But I do like how it kind of turns around that, of course, Sondheim then like twists the lyric a little bit and it's lovely, but lovely is the one thing I can do, but it's the way that I can share. It's something that I can share
it's
with
a gift
you.
I can share it's with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, loveliness is a skill. Now, I will say, I don't think that, I think this is much more of what we usually think of as a bimbo in fiction, which is a comic relief. I mean, every character in Funny Thing is a comic relief, so it's not like she's the one, but like... I mean, that's the whole point of the show.
There's no relief. It's just comedy.
It's just comedy. But I mean, this is much more when we think of a bimbo character in, you know, any kind of fiction, that's who we think of. Like, oh, isn't it funny how stupid she is and how everyone loves her so much because she's pretty and she walks in and she stops the room and, you know, sets off the plot is often how these characters work. I mean, I guess Helen of Troy or whatever, you know, like they're all, it's all the same thing. But I mean, the song is so great.
Yeah, that's a great song. She also has another song in the second act, That'll Show Him.
Which yeah. Not as familiar because I think mostly because I know that show more from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think That'll Show
That's him not in the movie.
Yeah.
I have
seen the show multiple times, but
yeah. Well, just on listening to it again, what it seems to give her, yeah. The song is about she's contractually going to this captain person, but she's in love with Hiro, and the song's kind of like, well, I'll show him because every time he kisses me and I kiss him, I'll be thinking of Hiro. And I'll,
and so I'll just kiss him harder and better. And that'll
right, right. Yeah. which is, you know, a very silly notion and not that smart. But I felt like it does kind of like give her a little agency in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, so even in this show where she is very much the prototype of a bimbo and markedly stupid. I mean, and again, in a show full of stupid people, she's one of them. But she does have feelings and she has some agency and, you know, the idea that she feels like her beauty has a purpose, is kind of nice. But the fact that she's there and that song Lovely and That'll Show Him are there in that show kind of underlines my thesis that this type of character is kind of fundamental to the Sondheim canon.
Mm-hmm.
Let the captain wed me and woo me. I will play my part. Let him make his mad passion to me.
Yeah, and April in Company kind of feels like a very similar character who is basically the comic relief in that show.
She is definitely the comic relief, and she's hilarious. But I think the strongest laugh line in maybe one of the stronger laugh lines in the whole show, and again, it's a line of dialogue, so it's not Sondheim, but is when she's talking about the butterfly.
Mm.
And she's like, you think it's going to be like, oh, she's sad about this butterfly, but it's no, like, this guy is an asshole for treating me like such, like,
right.
for being so mean to me. Like, you know, she actually kind of understands the situation of she's being manipulated and. You know,
yeah.
You know, she calls herself dumb. She she, or what does she say? I'm not very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
She's not, she has her own desires and stuff. Like, she's not just there to be laughed at.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, well, I think a lot of people who are cast in the bimbo type role for their, because of their looks or whatever, tend to be really smart when it comes to relationships, because they deal with that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, they maybe have the ability to be a bit more objective about that, because it's not like, who can I get? I can get anyone. It's right. I get to like actually decide what I'm interested in and come at it from that way.
Yeah, and then Sondheim writes Barcelona for her. Well, a duet, but which is one of the memorable.
I mean, that's one of the best songs ever written too. So
she's still like attuned to him, his emotions. Like, now you're angry.
Yeah, I do feel like they're probably a good match.
Where you going?
Barcelona.
Oh.
Don't get up.
Do you have to?
Yes, I have to.
Oh.
Don't get up. Now you're angry.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. Put your things down.
See, you're angry.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. Put your wings down and stay.
I'm leaving.
Why?
To go to.
Stay.
I have to
fly.
Fly,
I know, to Barcelona.
Yeah, I mean, actually, when I saw the gender reverse where it's Andy, then that I really saw, I was like, they are, put them together and let's go, because they are perfect. Yeah, people who are more in their head, like Bobby is very in his head or in her head, depending on the production. But it's nice to put them against somebody who's more emotional and like surface and upfront and direct,
which kind of brings us to our next pairing. So I think probably maybe the most important character in this is Dot. I do not like the way that George treats Dot. I do not think she should have forgiven him even in the afterlife. I'm not a fan. But Dot is certainly, you know, she has wisdom, and she understands art enough to understand that but George, you're good. she understands what's good, but you know, she can't read. All she wants to do is go to the Follies and dance, you know. She's definitely the hero of the piece, at least to me. I think to a lot of people, she's the hero of the piece. And clearly, everyone who wrote it loves her, is my sense. You know, anyone involved in the putting it together. Anyone involved in putting that show together must have loved Dot a lot and had deep respect for her. But with the understanding that she's not an intellectual person, and that her desires in life are pretty simple, right? When it comes to intellect, right? A big part of that is access to education, right? So a lot of people don't have access to education as children. And if you don't get access to education as a young child, learning a lot of things that people learn as kids is much, much harder as you get older. So, you know, if you get to be 9 or 10 years old and you haven't learned to read, no matter what happens for the next rest of your life, you're going to be at a disadvantage. I mean, that's just that's a thing I deal with a lot in my job. You know, Dot didn't learn how to read. I mean, we don't have any evidence that she had like an intellectual disability. She just never learned how to read, right? Like, which would be fairly typical for a lower class person in France at the time. I don't know that much about French history, but my guess, right?
Seems right.
Seems right.
Yeah, and then she's teaching herself, and that's...
And she's teaching herself to read, and she's moving to America and creating a mythology for her family and a lineage that could lead to her son being, or her great grandson, or great great grandson, whatever.
I think it's her great grandson. Yeah, because Marie is her daughter, who's George's next grandson. Yeah.
He was able to, you know, stand on her shoulders, and I just think that Dot is a wonderful person, and she doesn't necessarily need to be the smartest person to be a wonderful person.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, her character, because I feel like you do see her coming up against, like, she's drawn to the kind of intellectualism.
Yeah,
of George.
She does want it for herself, absolutely.
But she ultimately pulls away and goes to Louis, who's, in contrast to George, not, I mean, that's like the Everybody Loves Louis song, basically. It's like his art is easy. His art is the stuff you, not that baking is easy, but all the time, but his art is not the difficulty of trying to understand a painting. It's just something you pop in your mouth.
Louis is always so pleasant. Louis is always so fair. Louis makes you feel present. Louis is generous. That's the thing about Louis. Louis always is there. Louis' thoughts are not hard to follow. Louis' art is not hard to swallow. Not that Louis' perfection, that's what makes him ideal. Hardly anything worth objection. Louis drinks a bit, Louis blinks a bit, Louis makes a connection. That's the thing that you feel.
It seems like she wants both, I guess. I mean, when she is with George, she wants to go to the Follies, right? She wants to be with him and with his art. But she also, like, she always has that bit of wanting to have fun in life. And
yeah, it's like she's fascinated by that other way of life and of being, but ultimately goes a different way.
I guess the last one I had for us to talk about is in the new musical Here We Are, we have another one of these characters, and things being how they are, I've only seen it once.
Yes.
I've only heard the songs once. But I think a lot of people came out of the show with feeling like their most memorable is early in the second act, before they stop singing. There's this character who spent the whole first act in like a blue negligee pajamas, basically, but you know, sexy pajamas, I guess that's called the negligee, and they're in this really, the first act is in this kind of blank space that turns into a bunch of restaurants, and then the second act is in this very well-appointed, beautiful living room, and she's just like, this room is beautiful. And isn't it nice to be around beautiful things? And again, I was like, I feel you, lady. I love beautiful things. And I'm quite sure that and she really ends up being the most sympathetic and wonderful character in the show. And I don't remember the show well enough to talk about it beyond that. But once we have the recording, we will be able to go into more detail on how Here We Are fits into the Sondheim bimbo canon.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's hard to talk about the details of the show at this point, just because we only were able to see it and we only saw it once. The recording's not out yet. I don't think there's a published script or anything. So we're kind of going on memory. But I mean, I remember being so drawn to that character. Like, I mean, it could also be like, it definitely helped that Rachel Bay Jones was a great performer of that character. But it's just, every time she spoke. And I think also that the whole thing was absurd, but there was so much darkness to it that I kind of needed her.
Her lightness,
as it was going on. But and she dances with a bear. That's
like you do.
Yeah, but she definitely looked the part of a bimbo and was very ditzy. Again, Sondheim writing that very poignant moment with the bear.
I think there's more people who fall in this category. Maybe Rapunzel.
I guess you could make a case for Anne Eggerman from A Little Night Music.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry. How could I forget her? She definitely fits in. It is just a very common character in a lot. So I don't think it's necessarily that Sondheim is the only one who writes these characters. And he's definitely not the only one who respects them, as I'm about to get to. But like, I just feel like it's just a very strong theme in a lot of his work.
Yeah, well, it's just so notable because, as I said at the beginning, it's like, I don't usually think of these as being Sondheim's characters because I think of like, I don't know, well, like Bobby or, like people who are too smart for themselves.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Clara Hoover Hooper.
George or...
I think he has a lot of different kinds of characters, which is good. But this is definitely one that deserves attention. And so bringing in some other musicals, in your last two episodes, there was a reason I was like, I have to do this now, because you, in your last two episodes, you talked about Audrey and you talked about Adelaide, who I think are both also, excellent, very much bimbo characters, very sympathetic and wonderful. And I will say, I have a dog on my lap. I wanted to name her Audrey 3. And Adelaide, Adelaide has, you dissected the song in your previous episode. So I don't think I have a lot to add to that. But, she's not smart, but she's trying to understand a medical textbook. I mean, she's doing okay. And she knows what she wants, right? Like, she could probably have a lot of guys, but she wants Nathan and she gets what she wants, right?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of these kind of bimbo type characters around musical theater. But yeah, I think those two are really great ones.
Right before I did this, I told my husband I was going to do this and he was like, like Legally Blonde. And I was like,
yeah, Legally Blonde is also a great one. We were talking before about, there's the opening number. Oh my God, you guys, where it's all the bimbos.
Saying, no, it's not that Well, in her case, she is not dumb in any sense. She is very smart. But she is very blonde and she is very much who she is. She's definitely not dumb. I think some of the characters we talked about today are dumb. Mm-hmm. She's not.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about it. Yeah.
But she is, through the end of the movie at least, she is very much herself. She never, at no point does she, well, I mean, by the end of the movie, she finds that she doesn't have to change who she is fundamentally in any way in order to be successful and respected. That it, she doesn't have to conform to someone else's idea of what it means to be a smart girl or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that it is continuing the theme of respecting people for who they are.
Yeah. And it's like she's in the mold of a bimbo character, but like, but she doesn't, it's like she doesn't really see the difference. She's like, it's not any different for her. That she's not saying like, well, I'm not a bimbo. She's just like, well, I am smart. Like, I can go to.
I am all these things, and I am smart, and I am a lawyer, and
yeah. Like there's no like bimbo. Like the category of bimbo, I feel like doesn't even exist for her because it's like I'm just me. Like I'm just this. Yeah. You know.
And speaking of characters who are like, I'm just me, I'm just this. I would also, although I think she's a major deviation, I would point out Tracy Turnblad. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other characters who are kind of variations on this.
The show Grease, I guess, is like the opposite of it, where she like becomes kind of like a bimbo stereotype at the end, which is, I guess, what dooms that that story for a lot of people. All right, well, let's move on to Why Is This So Good? We're going to be talking about the song Glitter and Be Gay from Candide. So why did you pick this song for Why Is This So Good?
So as I mentioned, I love Candide a lot, and the music is just phenomenal, and the lyrics are actually really great too. And this song I felt like was on a theme for the episode. It's... Glitter and Be Gay is I don't know if the word bimbo is correct for her, but she's the character is Cunegonda, and she's just talking about what it's like to be passed around between men for jewels. The thing you have to understand is that there's like a kind of basic misunderstanding of what things like rape and sex are to a woman that, to be fair, is coming straight from Voltaire. So, you know, a long time ago, but kind of persisted for a long time. So the setup to the song is... So there's this character, Cunegonda, who is a rich young woman in a wealthy family. By the way, the story of Candide is bonkers. I mean, Candide was written before novels were really a thing. So it's more of an episodic, just like barrage of horrible things that happen to people and being kind of silly about it. At this point in the story, her home has been decimated and she's been kidnapped by various people and kind of tossed around. And, the setup that comes right before the song is that, she is ended up in Paris, and the Archbishop of Paris and a rich Jew have both taken a liking to her, and because they're both corrupt, obviously, because again, Voltaire, the line from the show is an agreement was reached whereby they shared her. So there's a thing like certain days of the week, the rich Duke gets her, and certain days of the week, the Archbishop gets her. And yeah, that's kind of the setup for the song. There's this basic misunderstanding of what sexuality is for a woman and what it is to be in sex slavery, basically, is what is happening in this song. And it's actually laid out in the song itself. So there's the verses. Alas for me, had I remained beside my lady mother, my virtue had remained unstained until my maiden hand was gained by some grand duke or other. As a young woman, she has this thing, which is her virtue. And that thing is meant to be traded for a position of honor. And then in the context of the song, she loses it to the least honorable thing possible, which is an archbishop who obviously, and a Jew, God forbid, gets his dirty hands on her. And so, you know, she has lost this one thing that she had that could do her any good in the world. Like the one thing that she's good for has been taken away. And so the song is her kind of, it starts with her lamenting. And in kind of a similar way to That'll Show Him that we were talking about earlier from Funny Thing. She's saying, oh, well, I will be honorable by enjoying these jewels, you know, like I really have no joy in this world, but I'll just pretend to enjoy these jewels. And then she kind of starts singing about it and then starts actually enjoying the jewels. And it's fantastic. It's a parody of opera, and Candide in general kind of toes or walks the line between operetta and musical. You could kind of see it as either one. I think in the original with Barbara Cook, it definitely came off as more of a musical, but since has been kind of made into more of an opera and is now often performed in opera houses and in concert versions also, because again, the story is bonkers and doesn't always work.
Yeah, I think I saw it once and I don't really remember it too well.
I think I've seen it twice in person. I think I saw it at, I feel like I saw it at City Opera many years ago. And I also saw a production in DC. And in the production in DC, Kunigunda starts the song in a bath, and through the song they dress her. So she's like naked in a bath, and then they like get her out of the bath into underwear and then clothing and then more clothing and then jewels and then more jewels. And I mean, I think you kind of have to during this song be playing with jewelry. Like that's an important part of the song.
Right.
And the music of it is just so freaking good. I mean, mm-hmm. She is a little bipolar in the song. She's kind of sways between crying in a very overly dramatic way and laughing in a very like Queen of the Night Mozart type of way. Like a lot of the song is the word ha, mm-hmm. as she's doing fancy operatic ha 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 ha's. And so in that way, it's kind of a reworking of a kind of a classic opera trope, which is the mad song. There's also a recording by Christian Chenoweth where she, like, again, she more Broadways it up, I think, rather than, I mean, she does have the voice that can handle right. this. I mean, I think it goes up to an E flat or something. Like, not everybody can sing this. Christian Chenoweth did some adorable things, like when she says, well, the line is, "Here I am in Paris, France," and she kind of, instead she goes, "Here I am in Paris, France." Mm-hmm. I mean, it's cute and it's in keeping. And I guess she, like, to come back to the theme, she kind of emphasizes the bimbo.
Mm. yeah, music by Leonard Bernstein and lyrics by Richard Wilbur, who was primarily a poet. He was a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry and the second U.S. Poet Laureate. So these are...
Yeah, I mean, there's some great lines in here. And again, they work because they're like nice rhymes, but they're also, like, if you think about them at all, just hilarious. And especially the way they're delivered. Some of it is actually spoken. Mm-hmm. Bracelets, lavaliers, can they dry my tears? Can they blind my eyes to shame? Can the brightest brooch shield me from reproach? Can the purest diamond purify my name? Like, it's poetry, but it's yeah. also, like, ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like, half the song is just her laughing.
Yeah, a lot of the song is on ha ha. Yeah. For a long time, but ha 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 ha. Yeah. And that's the operatic virtuosic part of it, is that one thing I love musically is when she does the kind of I'd have to really break this down, like, section wise to say which part this was, but it's like, I guess the chorus of ha ha's, but the ha 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 ha, yeah, ha 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 ha, that part. The first 1, 2, 4 measures of it, the first phrase of it is on the downbeat. The second phrase of it is offset by one beat.
Yeah.
And it is like playing with the accompaniment. The accompaniment is still, the accompaniment is the melody on the beat. She's singing the melody offset by one beat, and they're kind of in conversation with each other.
Yes.
It's very cool and it's very playful. It's like, it's Bernstein, I think, being very playful with the music and the song.
It's just a phenomenally difficult song to sing also.
Yeah. Well, interesting you bring up mad scenes, because that's kind of a feature of some mad scenes in opera where the singer is interacting with an instrument in the orchestration as part of the mad scene.
It's not a surprise that people talk about this show being really hard to stage. And, you know, people do make cogent musicals out of all sorts of bizarre source material, but That book is wild. And the show that they made from it is equally wild. Like, it's very episodic, and it's very, I mean, the whole point is just that every horrible thing that can happen to human beings just keeps happening to these people. Like, they each die sort of like four different times, and each time it's like, oh no, I'm still alive. But the fact that they made something this funny and this effervescent, I guess effervescent is really the most important word to go with this song. I mean, she is literally effervescing throughout it, except for the parts where she's really sad.
Yeah.
Observe how bravely I conceal the dreadful, dreadful shame I feel.
Well, let's move on to our final section, something wonderful, just something in the musical theater world that we are excited about coming up or that we want to give a shout out to.
So I guess there's so many great shows coming out. I am very busy right now and I have no idea what's happening, but I will plug my own stuff that I'm doing, which is that I sing with a Yiddish chorus called the Yiddish Philharmonic Chorus, and we are going to do a concert at Merkin Recital Hall on my birthday, June 16th. And the theme is immigration, and I believe the title of the concert is going to be From Vilna and Varsha to Washington Heights, about Jewish migration, and with a lot of Yiddish songs that people may or may not be, well, most of them people won't be familiar with. Although we are doing two that people will know. We're doing L'chaim in Yiddish and also a version of Beethoven's Ninth, which was rewritten like about 100 years ago with Yiddish lyrics, saying all men are brothers and talking about how the different races of man are all in this together. So, anyway,
very cool.
Look out for that.
Yeah, I guess for me, I saw two shows, two musicals this past week. One was Jelly's Last Jam, which was at City Center Encores.
Jealous. Oh, well. Oh, Jelly.
Yes, perfect. So fingers crossed that production has more life at some point soon. And I also saw the new Michael R. Jackson musical with composer Anna K. Jacobs, musical Teeth at Playwrights Horizons. And I'm not a horror movie person, so I wasn't sure how I was going to respond to the show, but it definitely won me over in the end. So if you are a horror movie person, you'll probably love it, no problem. But if you're not, there's still stuff to enjoy coming from somebody who does not like horror.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that show. I'm kind of a horror movie person. I guess we've had discussions about horror musicals before, and I do watch horror movies. I haven't seen Teeth.
Yeah, I never saw the movie, of course, not being a horror movie. Yeah. Doesn't
seem like quite your jam.
Yeah. Yeah, but no,
you really liked it. It
definitely won me over in the end. And I really enjoyed myself by the end. So I don't want to give anything away, so I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, it's really fun. It's a really good time. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Scene to Song. You can write to scenetosong@gmail.com with a comment or question about an episode or about musical theater, or if you'd like to be a podcast guest. Love this podcast? Help it find more listeners by rating it on Apple Podcasts and leaving a review. Follow on Instagram at Scene to Song, on Twitter or X at Scene Song, and on Facebook at Scene to Song with Shoshana Greenberg Podcast. Sign up for our monthly e-newsletter at scenetosong.substack.com and contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/scenetosong, where you'll get bonus material from many of the episodes. The theme music you are hearing is by Julia Meinwald, and check back in 2 weeks for our next episode.